Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. Nominated by President Reagan and confirmed in the Senate by a vote of 98-0, Antonin Scalia has since 1986 served as an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. Justice Scalia's most recent book, written with Brian Garner, Reading Law, The Interpretation of Legal Texts. On behalf of the Federalist Society and Uncommon Knowledge, Mr. Justice Scalia, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Glad to be here.
Segment one, Reading Law, quote, "We seek a return to the oldest and most commonsensical interpretive principle. In their full context, words mean what they conveyed to reasonable people at the time they were written," close quote. Mr. Justice, in this 236th year of our republic, why should it be necessary to devote more than 400 pages to a commonsensical principle?
That's a very good question. Well, the reason, as explained in the first part of the book, is that we've sort of gone off the rails, that nowadays, especially with regard to the Constitution, the accepted view, and the view stated by my court repeatedly, is that the words don't necessarily mean what they were understood to mean at the time, but can be given new meaning. It's up to the court to say what they mean today. They mean today what they ought to mean today, and it's up to the court to decide that. That's new, but it all comes under the title, the Living Constitution.
The Living Constitution. We'll get to that phrase.
Yeah.
But again and again,
I hate it.
You make that clear. Again and again, in reading law, it's like picking up cosmic background radiation from some distant cataclysmic event. A couple of quotations. "Since the mid-20th century, there's been a breakdown in the transmission of our heritage. Again, over the past 50 years especially, we've seen the judiciary take control of territory that ought to be settled legislatively. Once again, some commentators have claimed since the mid-20th century that all language is ambiguous. 50 years ago, something terrible happened." What was it? What went wrong? Why did it happen then?
Wow, that we don't try to explain why it happened then. It did happen then. The time that philosophy took over is about the time of the Warren Court. There had been, you know, hints of it earlier, I suppose, but it was never the accepted philosophy of the judiciary. The Living Constitution notion, the notion that all words are ambiguous, it's really up to the court to give them meaning, is much more attractive to academics than it is to judges. And it's really the academy that brought all of this into the prominence and into the majority status that it now enjoys.
So the court is the court lags the academy?
Yeah, I think probably. I think that probably there were law professors that were espousing these views before the courts adopted them.
All right. Reading law, once again, the purposivist, did I pronounce that one correctly?
Purposivist.
All right, the purposivist.
Yeah, you have to have some word for it. I made it up.
The purposivist derives the meaning of text from purpose and not purpose from the meaning of the text. That's related to the Living Constitution, or that's distinct?
That's distinct. Look, there are two things that the book urges lawyers to be and judges to be. Number one is textualists. Okay, the point you just made is a point urged by someone who is not at all a textualist. He doesn't want to be bound by the text at all. He just looks at what was the purpose of this text, and once he figures out, you know, any purpose can be identified at an infinite number of levels, at the top of which is, do good and avoid evil. And depending on what level of generality you pick, you can make a very narrow statute into a very broad statute, because the broad purpose that it seeks is this, and therefore even though the text does not specifically address that particular question, the question ought to be answered that way because of this text. That's a person who is not a textualist. He's a purposivist. Even if you are a textualist, though, and you say, yes, we're bound by the text, you can give the text the meaning it bore at the time, or you can say, and indeed, many of the living constitutionalists, they say, we are all textualists now. Yeah, they all start with the text.
Right. But they don't end with it.
They don't end with it, and they don't give it the meaning it had when the people adopted it. That's especially important when you're dealing with a constitution, because a constitution takes out of the democratic process certain particular items. And you're tampering with democracy when you remove items that the people really never agreed to remove. The death penalty is a good example. I've sat with four colleagues who thought it was unconstitutional, even though it's absolutely clear that the American people never, ever voted to make the death penalty unconstitutional. When the Eighth Amendment was adopted, the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause, the death penalty was the only penalty for a felony. It was the definition of a felony. Every state had the death penalty. So nobody could plausibly claim that the American people said no state shall have the death penalty. But I've sat with four colleagues who have taken that position and say the death penalty is unconstitutional, because it ought to be, because nowadays we ought to consider it cruel and unusual. That distorts democracy. It ought to be up to the American people to take something out of democracy, to take it away from, the Constitution doesn't require you to have the death penalty. You think it's a bad idea, persuade your fellow citizens and abolish it, as many states have done. But, to say that the American people rendered it beyond the pale of democracy is just absurd.
All right. Segment two, canons. Reading Law presents 57 canons. I'm quoting. Properly regarded, canons are not rules of interpretation in any strict sense, but presumptions about what an intelligently produced text conveys. Would you explain that?
Well, again, most of it is common sense. Let's right. take... Most of them are so, or many of them are so old that they have Latin names. One of them is inclusio unius exclusio alterius. When you include one thing, you exclude another impliedly. That's a fancy name for the negative implication. For example, when you say free loans for people with good credit. The implication is, if you don't have good credit, you don't get a free loan,
right.
Okay? That's inclusio unius, namely people with good credit. Exclusio alterius implicitly excludes others, those who don't have good credit.
So in 57 canons, and a number of the reviewers make a point that I have a feeling you'll be able to deal with just fine, but they make the point that the canons represent extra-textual assumptions that you bring to the text. So, Richard Posner, Judge Posner says, he quotes you here, close up there, reading law, the related statute canon is not, this is you, to tell you and your co-author, the related statute canon is not to tell the truth based upon a realistic assessment of what the legislature actually meant. The canon is based upon a realistic assessment of what the legislature ought to have meant. Those are your words. And then Judge Posner says, in other words, now I'm quoting his review, judges should impose right reason on legislators. Judges should, in short, clean up after the legislators.
So, no, I wouldn't say that with respect. Look, we say early on that some of the canons, such as inclusio unius, are just common sense. They are just the way people understand language. Others of them, however, have some, social or legal backing, that there's a legal reason for them. And the one we just talked about, that you should interpret statutes to be harmonious is one of those. You don't want to make a hash out of the corpus juris. And that's always been the rule. You don't interpret statutes to contradict each other if you can avoid it. Now, if you want to call that going beyond the text, I don't think so. I think that's anybody who enacts a statute should know that ancient rule and therefore should know that that's the way what they write will be interpreted. If they leave it vague, it will be interpreted to be conformable to prior statutes.
So you've got Judge Posner and Stanley Fish in the New York Times. Stanley Fish is a layman, of course, not a judge. And you've got Little Robinson here. It's clear, they're trying to find the distinction. It's clear that you bring bring a knowledge of the English language to the text.
Right.
You state, and all the reviewers agree, that words have no inherent meaning themselves. You bring a knowledge of the English language to the text.
Right. You can call that extra textual,
yes,
too.
Yes, exactly. So that's
sure.
So Posner says, well, wait a minute. He says you bring a knowledge of English to the text. He says you bring 57 canons to the text. Well, that's what Justice Scalia wants to bring to the text. Justice Breyer may want to bring a few other things to the text. How do you draw the distinction between what is the assumptions that are in the service of the text and those that open the door wide to judicial interference or fiat?
Some of them, as I say, are just standard manners in which people understand language, okay?
Right, got it.
And that's one whole category that the others can't complain about. Other ones are so traditional, they have been around so long, that anybody who's a legislator and writes a statute ought to know that that's the way it will be interpreted by the people and by the courts. An example of that is the proposition that when you have a listing at the end of the thing, at the end of a passage, which says something like dogs, cats, gerbils, parrots, parakeets, and other animals, that generalized term will not be interpreted to mean elephants. It will be interpreted to mean other animals of the same sort, namely domestic animals, pets. That's an ancient principle.
It's almost a question of legal grammar.
It's almost legal grammar, right. I can't say that every English-speaking person would understand that automatically, but every English-speaking lawyer would certainly understand that that's how courts have interpreted a phrase of that sort for hundreds of years.
Got it. Segment 3, Errors. Reading Law presents not only 57 canons. By the way, I should state for the television audience and the audience here, Stanley Fish, the reviewer in the New York Times, almost in spite of himself, called the book compellingly readable. I agree. The prose is just terrific. Almost the most fun, in my judgment, are the 13 falsities exposed.
Yeah, that was fun.
So let's take a couple of those. One of the 13 falsities, quote, the false notion that words should be strictly construed, strict constructionism as opposed to fair reading textualism, is not a doctrine to be taken seriously, close quote. Whereupon, I Googled Antonin Scalia plus strict constructionism, and you know what? A lot of people think you are a strict constructionist.
I know.
It is not a doctrine to be taken seriously. Explain that.
You should not interpret language strictly, nor should you interpret it sloppily. You should interpret it reasonably. Strict constructionists give a bad name to serious textualists who say language should be interpreted reasonably. The First Amendment is the example I always give. If you were a strict constructionist, you would have to believe that Congress could censor handwritten letters. Because all the First Amendment is that Congress makes abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. A handwritten letter is not speech, it's not the press, so it can be censored, right? No. I mean, a proper understanding of the First Amendment is speech, press, it means there's a figure of speech called, I see a sail where the part stands for the whole.
Yes, right,
right.
Is that synecdoche?
Synecdoche.
Synecdoche.
My God, that's brilliant.
Did
you have a Jesuit education?
I did not, but I grew up in upstate New York where the English teacher just said, think of Schenectady.
Ah, I see. Yeah, it is. It's
all right, so synecdoche.
Synecdoche, and I think speech and press are synecdoche, standing for the conveyance of ideas, expression, whether it's done by semaphore, by Morse code, by burning a flag, so long as it's your own flag, you're free to express yourself.
All right. Another falsity. Again, quoting Reading Law, the false notion that committee reports and floor speeches are worthwhile aids in statutory construction. Close quote. Mr. Justice Scalia, you
have no interest. How much time do we have?
You have no interest in probing the intent of a legislature.
Well, yes. You will rarely find a court that does not say the object of the construction is to discern the intent of the legislator. They say that all the time. I think Aristotle said that. I think it's wrong. At least it's wrong in a democracy. We are, as the famous line from the Massachusetts Constitution says, a government of laws, not of men. We are governed by the laws that Congress enacts, not by the unexpressed intent of whoever wrote them. And if they meant up when they said down, that's their problem. I frankly, if the legislative history is utterly clear about that, too bad. We're governed by the laws. So that's point one. You shouldn't be worried about their intent. Anyway, you should be worried about what was promulgated to the people. That's what they're governed by. But secondly, even if you were interested in legislative intent, are you going to find that in legislative history? For one thing, in a multi-member body, it's very hard to understand what the intent was beyond the words that they all voted on. Other than that, they could have voted for them for very different reasons. Just because one or two of them say, oh, I think the language does this, the rest may not have felt the same way. So the notion that you can pluck statements from a couple of legislators or even from a committee report, which is usually written by some teenagers and not even...
Members of the Federal Society, if we're lucky.
Very often not even read by the committee, much less read by the whole House, much less read by the other House. The notion that somehow is reflective of the intent of the whole Congress and of the president who had to sign the thing, I mean, it truly is the last surviving fiction in American law. There'd be a lot of fictions, you know? This is a fiction. You have to engage in a willing suspension of disbelief to accept that.
One last falsity. Quote, the false notion that the living Constitution is an exception to the rule that legal texts must be given the meaning they bore when adopted. Close quote. The argument, of course, is that the framers were wise men. They understood that they were constructing a document for the ages, so they left a little play in the joints. They permitted this thing to breathe, to expand, to adapt. And the body charged with executing these expansions and adaptions is the judiciary.
Yeah. No, they knew that there would be need for change, and that's why they had an amendment provision, as some constitutions did not. This constitution could be amended. And if you listen to John Marshall, in the Bank of the United States case, what enables the application of the Constitution to new situations that can't be envisioned by the framers is not the ability of the courts to change the meaning of the Constitution, but rather when the courts interpret provisions of the Constitution, they ought, as John Marshall said, to give those provisions an expansive meaning because they have to they have to be used in situations that cannot possibly be envisioned now. That's the way in which the Constitution is expandable and flexible, not by being amendable through the courts.
Has the political and legal culture evolved such that we amend the Constitution much too seldom?
You mean the people, through the formal amendment.
The court does
it all the time. Well, I'm sometimes asked, you know, if I would amend any provision of the Constitution, and actually the one provision I would amend is the amendment provision. It's very, very difficult to amend it, infinitely more difficult than it was when that provision was written. You know, it takes a two-thirds vote of each house to propose the amendment, and then it has to be approved by three-quarters of the states. I figured it out once. If you took a bare majority in the smallest states in population, something less than 2% of the population could prevent a constitutional amendment. That's probably too severe, and certainly much worse than it was. You know, the disparity in population between California and Rhode Island is so much greater than what existed at the framing. So I would amend that.
Segment 4, how it should be done and how it should not. How it should not, Roe versus Wade. Two quotations, reading law. In Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court declared unconstitutional state statutes that in no way contradicted any specific provision of the Constitution, close quote. Second quotation, Justice Blackmun, 1973 opinion itself. The right of privacy, whether it be founded in the 14th Amendment's concept of personal liberty, or as the district court determined in the 9th Amendment's reservation of rights to the people, is broad enough to encompass a woman's decision whether or not to terminate her pregnancy, close quote. So Justice Blackmun, writing for the majority, takes pains to ground the court's decision, well, I suppose you could, in the 14th and the 9th, or if you read his opinion carefully, it's the 14th or the 9th, you get to choose. And he's wrong.
Did he say the 14th?
The right of privacy, whether it be founded in the 14th Amendment's concept of personal liberty, as we feel it is, or as the district court determined in the 9th Amendment's reservation of rights to the people.
Well, once again, this is one aspect that the book addresses. When you have terms in the Constitution that are not ambiguous in the sense that they can mean one of two things, but rather are general so that they could cover a lot of things. You should interpret them not to cover the things that the people who adopted that provision did not think they covered. And, you know, cruel and unusual punishments is one. Of course, those words could cover a lot of things, but it's clear from the history of the times that nobody thought that it included the death penalty. Nobody. And it's the same thing with this right of abortion, whether it's founded in the 14th or, I mean, God, the 9th Amendment, forget about it. Nobody ever thought that. I mean, just look at history. All the states had prohibitions on abortion for hundreds of years. So when was it that the American people made the decision to forbid a state from adopting such?
They never did.
They never did. The court made it up. And you know, we're not talking about the right or wrong of the substantive result. I mean, I'm quite, you know, neutral on that. The point is, who should decide? Should it be a question on abortion, whether people try to persuade each other that there ought to be, there oughtn't to be, and put it to a vote? That's fine. If you want the right to abortion, create it the way most rights are created. In a democracy, you persuade your fellow citizens, pass a law. You want to abolish the death penalty, the same thing. But all of that democratic choice is taken away when the court is enabled to give vague provisions such as due process of law, equal protection of the laws, meanings that they did not have when they were adopted.
How it should be done. 2008 case of District of Columbia versus Heller, in which you wrote the decision upholding the individual right to possess firearms a decision that runs to more than 60 pages of very close textual and historical analysis. Reading law, quote, "The Second Amendment did not say that the people shall have the right to keep and bear arms, or even that, quote, the government shall not prevent the people from keeping and bearing arms, but rather that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." This triggered historical inquiry. So how does the history inform the reading of what strikes a layman like me as a very tricky text, that prefatory clause, comma?
Well, that passage you read triggered, historical inquiry because the Second Amendment refers to it as though it were a pre-existing right. It didn't say the people shall have the right, or even the government shall not take away arms, but rather the right of the people to keep and bear, as though it was a pre-existing right. And that triggered historical inquiry that takes you back to the English Bill of Rights, which, sure enough, contained the right to keep and bear arms. As for the prologue, are they going to know what the prologue is? You know, a well-regulated militia being necessary for the defense of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Again, if you studied history, what's the connection between not taking away arms, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, and the militia? It seems very strange. But historical inquiry shows you what the connection is. The way the Stuart kings, the Catholic kings, destroyed the militia, which was supposed to be all of the male citizens trained to arms, the way they destroyed the militia was not by abolishing it. They just took away the arms of all of those who opposed the Catholic kings. And so there is a connection. A well-regulated militia being necessary for the defense of a free state, a militia consisting of all of the body of the citizenry, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It makes thorough sense if you understand the history. And without the history, you ask yourself, what is this guarantee of the state's ability to have a militia? What is it doing in the Bill of Rights, for Pete's sake? Why isn't it some other portion of the Constitution?
Segment 5, forward and afterward. In reading law, your views are definite. For that matter, the prose itself just conveys a sense of solidity. But you include a foreword by Judge Frank Easterbrook that tosses a banana peel right into the middle of the argument. Quote, quoting Frank Easterbrook's foreword, "The significance of an expression depends on how the interpretive community alive at the time of the adoption understood those words. The older the text, the more distant that interpretive community from our own. At some point, the difference becomes so great that the meaning is no longer recoverable." Close quote. So the Constitution of the United States slowly fading away before our very eyes.
Well, I can't disagree with it. I wouldn't have written that. I don't know why Frank wrote that. But it's
once you invited him to write the foreword, you were stuck.
It's undoubtedly, well, yeah, Frank's all right. He knows what he's doing. And he is as much of a textualist as I am. What he said there is entirely true. I mean, when you can't recover the historical meaning, of course you can't do textualism. But that's not the case with respect to the provision of the Constitution that I'm talking about. We know what the laws were at the time the Bill of Rights was adopted in 1791. We know what the laws of the various states were, and those laws were unchanged, which shows that those people did not think the death penalty was forbidden.
You make a contrary point in reading law that when you first were elevated to the High Court, amicus briefs that included historical background were relatively unusual, and now they have become standard. So would it almost be right to argue that the history is coming more sharply into focus rather than fading away? Is that fair?
That's fair.
I'm just making that up.
But that's fair.
It's fair. All right.
I wouldn't have made the point, but it's a fair point. I mean, the history is either there or it's not there. If, as Frank said, you can't retrieve it anymore, yes, it's an obstacle to giving the text its original meaning. I guess you have to fall back on, gee, I don't know what it meant originally. although I'm not sure what you would say is therefore it means what I think it ought to mean, but anyway. It's a true statement, but it's not a criticism of proper historical inquiry where the history has not been lost, and it hasn't been lost for
all right.
most of this stuff.
That's Judge Easterbrook's foreword. Here's from your own afterword. Quote, reading law, some will argue that a widespread adoption of the techniques we advocate in this book would be to turn back the clock. But we do not propose that all decisions made and doctrine adopted in the past half century or so of unrestrained constitutional improvisation be set aside. We must bow to stare decisis. Close quote. Mr. Justice Scalia, it's not a matter of turning back the clock. It's a matter of restoring the original meaning of the Constitution. You put for 400 pages, you show you have 400 pages of Mozart, and you end with 2.5 pages of a Bronx cheer. You take it all back. Say it ain't so.
Okay, so counsel appears before us in the case, and he's about to argue that a statute enacted by Congress is unconstitutional. But before he gets into it, wait, counsel, now. Do you think we have the power to ignore a statute enacted by Congress simply because, in our view, it's unconstitutional? He says, yes, Your Honor, you know, Marbury versus Madison. I know, Marbury, but was it right? Let's rethink that. You can't run a legal system that way, reinvent the wheel every time you have a new case. You have to accept, you know, water over the dam. And that's what stare decisis is all about.
Stare decisis is Latin for water over the dam.
That's what it is Latin for, right.
Okay. So, but then you provide these criteria for deciding whether stare decisis should rule. And the criteria are just as vague as the criteria that Judge Posner might impose in reading looking for legislative intent. Is it settled law? Have people arranged their lives around it and so forth? This is all in the afterword.
Yeah,
no?
Number one, the number of items to which this vagueness applies is much less than the number of items to which Judge Posner's vagueness applies. I mean, you know, the world is his oyster. Any statute can be interpreted to do what it ought to do. But secondly, I don't think those criteria that I set forth there are so vague. I set forth three that I employ. Number one, how wrong was it? Is it, you know, was it blatantly wrong? Some of them are maliciously wrong. They must have known they were lying. Okay,
that's Plessy. Plessy's on the books for over a half a century before Brown comes along.
That's just one of my criteria.
All right.
Number two, has it been generally accepted? When I was in law school, the incorporation doctrine was still controversial, whether the 14th Amendment had the effect of applying the Bill of Rights to the states. It didn't used to apply to the states. But it's been accepted for half a century now, and it's no big deal. Number three, or compare that with Roe versus Wade,
right,
which was controversial when adopted and remains so. And apply the first criterion to Roe versus Wade. You know, how bad was it? Even the people that liked the outcome acknowledged that it was a lousy opinion. Third factor, and for me the most important, really, can I work with this case as a lawyer? And again, the best example is Roe versus Wade. I don't know how to do Roe versus Wade. I'm supposed to say, does this particular state statute place an undue burden on the woman's constitutional right? How do I know whether it places none? I'm a lawyer. I would normally run to the law books and see, you know, what's an undue, what do you know? For 200 years, no burden was an undue burden. You could forbid it. This is a policy judgment. I mean, you have a statute that requires so many doctors, so many nurses, so much expensive equipment, and it raises the price of abortion. And the issue for my court will be, does this place an undue burden? What am I supposed to do with that as a lawyer? You think we're going to talk about law? We're not going to talk about law. We're going to say, somewhere. I don't think that's an undue. Do you think it's an undue burden? How many things? I mean, five hands it is, four it isn't. I'm not going to do that. But, you know, those are my three criteria. I don't think they're very vague at all. And when I find that they strike out on all three, I don't adhere to the prior case.
Final question before we go to questions from the audience. Reading law, quote, originalism does not always provide an easy answer, or even a clear one. Originalism is not perfect, but it is more certain than any other criterion. And it is not too late to restore a strong sense of judicial fidelity to text, close quote. So here's the question. This book, for that matter, your entire career, represents a sustained, determined effort at restoration. Are you optimistic? How's the project coming?
That's an unfair question. Especially after last term. I dissented in the last six cases announced last term. So, I don't know. I don't know that I'm optimistic. The fight is worth fighting, win or lose. You know, Frodo in The Lord of the Rings. You soldier on. Look, the problem is that the other approach is enormously seductive. Even for the average citizen, it's seductive to think that the Constitution means what it ought to mean. It's a living Constitution. Anything I care passionately about, it's right there in the Constitution. You know, people used to say when they don't like something that's going on, they say, there ought to be a law. There used to be a comic strip that you know, there ought to be a law about people playing boom boxes in the park and stuff like that. People don't say that anymore. They say, it's unconstitutional. If they really feel passionately about it. And it is even more seductive to judges. It's a wonderful thing to have a constitutional case, and you're always happy with the result because it means exactly what you think it ought to mean.
Let me ask that last question in a slightly different way, but it's the same question. I was talking to a friend here at Stanford Law School who said when Antonin Scalia was nominated to the Supreme Court in 1986, in the legal academy at prestigious law schools, originalism was considered dead and gone. And now, if you don't have some pretty good originalists on your faculty, your law school is not to be taken seriously. And that is overwhelmingly the work of one man. Now that I put that
way. You give me hope. You give me hope, Peter. Stay with me. Stay in my chambers.
All right, we have some questions. We have some questions from the audience.
We've made some progress. I will say that.
This is a Federalist Society that's sponsoring this event. It didn't exist. Questions from the audience. Is there a negative effect on the judiciary of the modern confirmation process? You were confirmed 98 to zip. Those days are over, aren't they?
I think they are over. My explanation for why they're over is... that I told you all this stuff really begins with the Warren Court, or at least that's when this living constitutional philosophy sort of takes over. And I think it took the American people a while to figure out what was going on, maybe 30 years. But once they have figured out that the Supreme Court is essentially rewriting the Constitution, term by term, the old criteria for appointing and confirming judges no longer apply. I mean, it's fine to get somebody who's a good lawyer. That's very nice. And somebody with a judicial disposition, wonderful. You know, somebody who, is an honest man, so forth. That's all very good. But the most important thing is, what kind of a new constitution will this person write? Will he put in the things that I like and take out the things I don't like? And that's what's been going on in recent confirmation processes, at least where the Senate is not overwhelmingly in the control, the filibuster-proof control of one party. you know, Judge so-and-so, do you think there's a right to, whatever it is, abortion, whatever you hate or love? You don't? Well, I think it's there, and my constituents think it's there, and I'm not going to put you on the Supreme Court. That's what's going on. And it ought to go on. Much as I hate that process, I prefer to the alternative, which is just letting the Supreme Court, without any political control, rewrite the Constitution term by term. If they're going to be doing that, I would like some popular control, even if it's in this Byzantine fashion that amounts to a mini-constitutional convention every time we appoint a new justice.
So the corruption of the process stems from the high bench, not from the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Yes, they are doing what you would expect them to do and what I say they ought to do. If that's what the Supreme Court is doing, that's what the Senate ought to do, much as I dislike the whole thing.
How much of the living Constitution is due to the feckless unwillingness of Congress to tackle difficult issues?
Well, I don't think that's a good excuse. Oh, Congress hasn't done it, so we must do it. Where do you get that from? None of it. Zero. Don't blame it on the Congress. It's not the job of judges to do those things which the people's representatives have, for whatever reason, decided not to do.
Even when we have, as we had...
Even when they're feckless.
Even when we had, as we had a couple of years ago, a sitting Speaker of the House referring to a 2,000 and some page document, we'll have to pass this to find out what's in it.
Yeah, I don't think it's up to the court to...
All right. You're not a safety net.
Oh, God, certainly not.
Does natural law have a place in interpreting the Constitution?
No. Look, it says what it says. I apply United States law. I don't apply natural law. God applies natural law. The only... Now, natural law has a place in writing law. When you're writing a constitution or when you're writing a statute, you should not put in that anything that you know or believe is contrary to natural law. But once it's in there, it says what it says. And if it forces me to do something that's against my conscience, of course, I have to resign from the bench. But the mere fact that it doesn't conform to natural law, but that does not cause me to be doing anything evil, that's no basis for me saying, oh, the statute doesn't conform to natural law, so I'll apply the natural law. No, that's... The only role natural law has under the Constitution is... Did you mention the Ninth Amendment in one of your earlier questions?
I did. Well, Justice Blackmun mentioned it.
Yeah, Justice Blackmun did. Well, you know, that's the amendment that says the enumeration herein of certain rights shall not be deemed to deny or disparage other rights that are retained by the people. And academia in recent years, having finally yielded to the reality that substantive due process, which has been the basis for Roe versus Wade and a lot of the living constitution nonsense, having finally conceded that that doesn't make any sense, they're looking for other ways to get there, and one of the ways is the Ninth Amendment, which is a source of unenumerated rights. It isn't a source of unenumerated rights. I apply the Ninth Amendment. I apply it rigorously. I do not deny or disparage other rights. Maybe there is a right to abortion. That's not my line of territory. You're free to argue to the legislature that there is. But I know that it's not one of the rights contained in the Bill of Rights and therefore not one of the rights that I enforce. What the Ninth Amendment was the expression of the framers' belief in the natural law. Just because we have a few rights here doesn't mean that there aren't any others. And if you try to take them away, we'll be back on the barricades. That's what it meant.
Procedure and evidence were once the province of precedent case law, common law. More recently, they've been codified. Question, would it make sense to codify federal rules of statutory interpretation? Should we take reading law and make it statute?
I wouldn't like to do it because I am loath to think that it's up to Congress to tell us how to decide cases. I mean, suppose they decide to say you shall not use logic. Or suppose they say you shall seek to achieve the purpose that Congress had in mind. No, no. I'm a judge. We're our own branch, And our responsibility is precisely to decide how to interpret statutes. And I am not in favor of having that written in a statute.
Last question, a question appropriate to Silicon Valley.
We would ignore it anyway, you know.
You know, I have to say, I know some of the students here at Stanford Law School who are in this audience, and they spend 3 years cowering before the faculty, and I've seen smiles break out a number of times, and I know exactly why, because you over and over again have given these people the back of your hand. It's refreshing to my young friends. If the First Amendment's text refers only to speech and press, you've explained that it doesn't quite, but how can you expand it to cover the internet without causing all kinds of problems?
The internet is, I told you, it doesn't mean just speech and press, it means expression. The internet is one form of expression. The notion that an originalist cannot handle these new phenomena, radio, television, cameras. Of course, you envision the need to take the principles that you've applied to face-to-face speech and applied that to any new phenomena that come along. That is not the living constitution. That's just applying the principles to new phenomena. Where the shoe pinches is where you're dealing with phenomena that did exist at the time. The death penalty, abortion, homosexual sodomy, to treat them differently today from the way they were treated earlier. That's a different question, and that's basically what the principle of originalism sets its face against. As to phenomena that existed at the time, the American people took out of the democratic process only what they understood to be taking out of it, and nothing more.
Antonin Scalia, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court and the...
You haven't talked about Brian, my co-author.
And the co-author with Brian A.
Brian's
Garner.
A great man. He's the foremost philologist in the United States, editor of Black's Law Dictionary. And portions of the book are identifiably Brian Garner's, for Pete's sake. There's a whole appendix on the use of dictionaries. You don't think I wrote that. And there's... He says one of the things you have to know, I didn't know this, he said one of the things you have to know about dictionaries is what is the principle on which they decide what order to put their definitions in. And he cites an opinion of my good friend and colleague, Steve Breyer, which made a mistake because it used the Oxford English Dictionary. It used the first meaning as the most common meaning. And that is not the system the Oxford English Dictionary uses. They put the oldest meaning first and then come up to the new. Now, I would have made the same mistake, to tell you the truth. But that whole thing is bright. It's very useful. It also has, what are the definitive dictionaries of each era? Because you want to use a dictionary from the time. You don't want to use today's meaning for the 1700s. And he's good on all that stuff.
Okay, let me hold this up to the camera
and try it one more
time.
Brian Garner, down at the bottom.
Brian Garner, down at the bottom. And seated next to me, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court and co-author with Brian Garner of Reading Law, Antonin Scalia. Thank you very much, Mr. Justice Scalia.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.